session number 6095, Reel 1.
Mr. Fouanet, Reel 1. You joined the RAF in 1940, Mr. Fouanet. Can you tell me how it came about?
Yes, this was mainly by conscription, although at the time I thought that I might volunteer. The powers that be decided that it was best to take your turn and join up as and when they called you up. So I waited until my turn came, which was in August 40.
How old were you then?
25.
And what type of work did you go into once you got in after your initial training?
Well, I was straight away sent for training as a pilot, and I carried through the course through the up to the elementary flying, and unfortunately my handling of an aircraft was not up to the Air Force standard, so they failed me and sent me back to Babbacombe for remustering as a UT observer, which was the professional description in those days of navigators come bomb aimers come air gunners.
Was it unusual for someone who was an AC2 to be selected for pilot training?
No, everybody joined as AC2 under the Conscription Act, or at the lowest grade, and then you had to work your way through. But I was told at my interview that I had been selected for possible commission, and I was sent straight down onto the training course with that in mind.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the training involved for becoming a navigator?
From a navigator, yes. It was the obviously navigation as such, meteorology, and of course combined with that in our course we had this air gunnery and bombing, which we were required to do at that time, when, for example, on Wellingtons. The main thing was actually, of course, navigation, although I must admit probably the training we got was not terribly brilliant. We did it in bad weather up in Scotland in the winter months of 1941. Unfortunately, we flew out to various islands in that area, which were not so difficult to pinpoint. But, of course, when we came back and to do our later training at pre-operational unit, flying over England was not so good in the poor weather that was around at that time. So we naturally got lost quite a few times. And then we got thrown in the deep end onto squadron work and flying across the North Sea with very little aid except for RDF loops. Our navigation was not up to scratch, and as you probably have read in many of the documents and books written since, the Bomber Command were very alarmed at the poor results taken from the photographs taken during bombing action. And this was the start, presumably, of investigation of mechanical aids to navigation, which started to come out in the 41, 42, 43 period.
What type of aircraft were you training on?
Well, we flew in some large aircraft while we were up in Prestwick, called a Fokker. I'm not certain which one it was, but the whole of the class used to go in this Fokker, and we used to plot on little transparent covered maps with indelible pencils, and we used to plot our course and then get checked by our instructor on board that we were following the right lines and work out winds from that. The information which was handed to us. And later on we did more individual work in Anson's, generally with Polish pilots who used to alarm us, and I've no doubt we alarmed them by our inability to find the necessary spots.
How did they alarm you?
Well, they were a bit mad in their handling of aircraft, and as we were allegedly rookies, they made certain that we appreciated that aircraft didn't always fly straight and level.
Do you think they were doing it deliberately to put the wind up you?
I think they did it for having a bit of fun with us, particularly at the bombing range where we used to drop our small 25-pound practice bombs, and the instant the last bomb had gone, they used to stuff the nose down and go down into a screaming dive, and you nearly got thrown out. This was in fairy battles, and you had a nice little open spot in front of you where the bomb site was, and you felt you were sort of pinned to the floor, and any moment you thought yourself going to slide out through the opening. But that was all good experience, no doubt.
You converted to Wellingtons when in 1941. How did you find Wellingtons to fly?
Well, they were marvellous aircraft, but I was horrified to discover that the ones that we were flying, particularly at the operational training unit, did a maximum speed of about 120 miles an hour. Having trained on Ansons, which also did about 120, we imagined that operational aircraft flew much faster than that. So when we got in our first Wellingtons, to discover that that was the sort of speed which we flew at was absolutely horrifying. But as far as the aircraft were concerned, they were magnificent.
In what way?
Well, general feeling of safety, of course. They were a unique construction. They were geodetic construction, which with only a silk skin on the outside or cotton skin on the outside, but the actual members were very, very strong and gave you a feeling of comparative security anyhow, because they could knock out quite a lot of the framework and the aircraft was still perfectly strong to get you home or down.
What kind of space did the navigators have on the Wellingtons?
Well, we just had our table, which was behind the... We had the... at the time I was flying, we had a pilot and second pilot who was a pilot getting training, which we eventually decided was rather wasteful because so many were lost before they'd actually taken over an aircraft themselves. But immediately behind the pilot was the wireless operator, and then the navigator sat behind the wireless operator sideways on with his table, and we were blacked out, of course, being night bombers. So we could have a reasonable light on our navigation table for doing all our plotting. We were rather fortunate too, insofar that we had a hot air pipe coming up between our legs, which took heat from the engines. So I just flew in an ordinary Sidcot, which was one of the flying suits, rather than wearing all the heavy gear that the other members of the crew had to wear.
Was it cold for the rest of the crew?
Oh, yes. Of course, the rear gunner had to have electrically heated suits. They had the leather-lined, lambskin-lined leather jackets and the similar trousers. And these were electrically lined and very clumsy boots, which were all electrically warmed. And they plugged it into the aircraft system to keep their hands and feet warm. And the front gunner as well, of course.
When did you go on to operational duties?
I arrived on the squadron in August 1941, and I was a spare bod. I didn't go with the crew, which was unusual, or possibly wasn't in those days, so I had to wait until enough people arrived to make up a crew, and eventually I was crewed up with the flight commander, squadron leader, then Abraham. He's changed his name since the war, actually, to Ward. I think my first operation was at the end of September or beginning of October. We did a trip to Boulogne.
Before we go on to that operation, can you tell me what the squadron was?
Number 12 squadron at Winbrook.
What kind of a squadron was it?
Well, it was a three-flight squadron stationed at Winbrook in Lincolnshire. I think we had about eight aircraft per flight, or was it, or more? So the total squadron capability was something in the order of 24 onwards of aircraft, if they were all fit.
And these were Wellingtons, were they?
Wellingtons, Mark II, the Merlin type, which was, there were not a great number of them equipped with Merlin engines. The idea being that the original Wellington was a Pegasus engine, but they found that the Merlin engine gave a greater power, and they thought that by fitting two Merlin engines, you get a better performance, and the aircraft would maintain height, etc., on one engine alone.
Did you find that to be true in practice?
Well, that was exactly what we didn't find. As a matter of fact, that's why we came down, because we were hit by flak over silt. We lost the glycol in one engine, which then seized up. And despite endeavouring to get rid of most of the heavy material on board, we lost height steadily until we came down to about 1,500 feet.
We'll come on to your shooting down in more detail later, but can you tell me what kind of a squadron, 12th Squadron, was to serve with?
It was one of the oldest of the squadrons. It was the first squadron, incidentally, to get a VC during the Second World War, and we had two VCs on the Maastricht Bridge in May 1940, flying off the Garland and Sergeant Gray on a sort of suicidal volunteer operation to try and destroy the bridges at Maastricht. And unfortunately, they dived straight in, I believe, and hit the bridge. Several other crews were lost as well. And actually, I did meet a survivor of one of the operations actually in Germany after I arrived there. So it was a squadron with a long history, and also it was formed, of course, I think it was 1915, one of the very early squadrons. And it served in France, of course, in ferry battles, and then it came back to England and was re-equipped with Wellingtons in 1940. And of course, later on, in 42, went on to Lancasters.
So what was morale like in the squadron?
I would say very good. At that time, of course, no squadron had very heavy losses. It was a fairly, almost a gentleman's war still. And we all flew individually rather than in packs. So that it was our survival was virtually up to ourselves, really. We could take any action we liked, provided we reached the target and got back again. And I think it was a very happy squadron. I loved life there, and I only regret that it lasted not much more than 6 months.
You said that your first operation was over Boulogne.
Yes.
Can you tell me what happened then?
Yes, well, the idea was that to give you what was called a fresher, and gave the first two or three trips for a newish crew. We're always to comparatively easy targets just over the border. And, of course, Boulogne was one of the places where they were assembling barges for the invasion. We took off that one we try and learn by our mistakes. And in that particular one, apparently I'd forgotten to turn on the switches from the for the bombing releases. So as we ran over the target, nothing happened. So we had the privilege of going round again and starting off from scratch again. It's a situation which never occurred again, because that taught me quite a good lesson. No doubt the pilot told me a few things, which I can't quite remember now. But he went off very successfully, and I could see the bombs exploding down one of the causeways and piers in the dock area.
Was there much opposition?
Not a great deal, no.
Can you remember any other particular raids that you were on before the one on which you were shot down?
Well, there was one raid, I must admit, was extremely disappointing. It so happened that being the navigator for the flight commander, we lost two flight commanders in one night on a raid on Berlin in September 1941. So the order came that flight commanders were to limit their number of operations to one or two a month. As a result, of course, I was grounded at the same time, but on the other hand, I was on standby for flying with any other crew, that if their navigators or fell ill or were on leave. And on one occasion, I was asked to take over at very short notice on a on a raid. I think we were supposed to be going to Hamburg that night, but there again, I didn't know the crew. I only knew the pilot, and as I relied on RDF loops, the radio direction finding loop, the wireless operator didn't know my requirements quite so easily as my own one, and to be honest, we got in a bit of a mess from navigation point of view. And whereas I told the pilot that we should go on for another 5 minutes before turning down, he reported back to me and said that he could see Emden on our starboard side and that he felt that we should turn down. Well, I took his word for it, and from then onwards we just floated around North Germany without finding our target, and we managed to find an aerodrome with its lights on and dumped our bombs on that. But it was a good example of cooperation being of paramount importance, and that this business of makeshift crews was not very efficient.
You felt it was necessary for the crews to know each other, did you?
Oh, I feel so, yes. Later on, possibly when we had all the navigational aids which were available, probably that wasn't necessary. Or when the Pathfinder's system was in operation, I think probably there was less need for it. But particularly at that time where you went as a sort of lone, I mean, the squadron set off, but you didn't set off, in, as I said, in packs. You went off on your own. So you had nobody to follow. And if you didn't make a landfall, which was positively identified, you were in a mess.
What did you think of this system of lone aircraft?
Well, as it was the only one I knew, I suppose we thought it was quite a good idea. But obviously it had its advantages insofar that you could probably take a different route from from some of your others and possibly avoid trouble. Against that, of course, you were liable to be picked up because you were the only one. And that's possibly why we got shot down, because I was 50 miles off course, slightly north of track, and I ran over the island of Sylt, which didn't relish intruders.
Can we go on now to that raid on which you were shot down, and can you describe to me in as much detail as possible what happened on the raid?
Well, it was fairly uneventful. We were scheduled to bomb Kiel, and we set off in the usual way. I think we took off at 23:30 on the night of the 25th of February, 42, beg your pardon. Naturally, we go straight out from Binbrook. It's straight out across the North Sea. And as was usual at that time, there was 9/10 cloud most of the way, so there was very little possibility of seeing anything. My checks on winds were reliant on RDF loops, which, as you left this country, gradually got weaker and weaker. And we often used to try and pick up the German signal stations, of which we had a code. But we made landfall, and we recognised this as the island of Sylt, at least I did. And much to our horror, they opened fire on us, and we had a shell burst just underneath us. The impact was quite powerful, and we assumed that some flak went through the radiator cooling system of of one of the engines, which the pilot eventually, as the temperature rose, he feathered feathered the prop. We then decided that the only thing to do was to turn back because we started to lose height. But unfortunately, it was very heavy icing conditions, and having flown back on our course for about 10 minutes or quarter of an hour, he took a consensus of opinion of the rest of the crew, and we decided that probably we wouldn't make it with the icing conditions. So we turned back and decided to make for Sweden. By that time, we were getting down into the more heavy air, and I think we were only making a ground speed of about 60 or 70 miles an hour. And we also were losing height steadily until such time as the pilot said, well, we're down to 2,000 feet. And despite the fact that we tried to dump any heavy equipment which we had, any loose equipment such as sextants and the cameras. Of course, we had a very heavy camera in the nose of the aircraft, but the nuts on that were iced up. We couldn't undo those. The gunners were not very keen on dumping all their ammunition either, and so really we made a bit of a mess of it until we got down to about 2,000 feet and the pilot decided that the only thing to do was to bail out. By that time we were over water again, so he turned the aircraft round, and as soon as we made a landfall, we were given orders to bail out. And eventually I was the last but one out. I got out just about 1,500 feet and the pilot followed me. And we all landed down on the island of Funen near Odense, in about 3 or 4 feet of snow.
Can you tell me what you did then once you would?
Well, the first thing to do was to bury a parachute and remove a flying, or at least I removed my flying Sidcot, so that I didn't look quite so conspicuous. But I wasn't certain where we were at that time. We had hoped possibly we might have got across to Sweden, but with the toing and froing, I must admit I'd lost my air plot, and so I wasn't too sure where we were. And the fact that we were in 3 or 4 feet of snow, one couldn't even find the roads. So you sort of ploughed through a field until you came to some form of track, and eventually I found a farm. Well, our instructions were that often the farm was a fairly safe place in a neutral country. So I went in and saw one or two farm people who just got up to look after the cows or whatever it was at that time of the morning. They were rather surprised to see me, not unnaturally, and called the farm owner. He took me in and offered me cup of coffee and a sandwich, and said, unfortunately, we know that there's an aircraft has come down in this area, and the Germans will know it, he sent off for the Danish police. The Danish police arrived and searched me to check that I had no arms, and he apologized for the fact that because the Germans knew an aircraft had come down, that he had to notify the German authorities of my presence. So I was taken then into the German barracks, signal barracks in Odense.
Can you tell me what happened to you there?
Well, we all six of us met up in the same barracks that morning, and we were given a bed in the signals barracks. The pilot and I were put in a separate room as being officers, and we were given a double bunk bed in the barracks, vacated by two of the signals people, who were very curious and interested in us, and were very friendly, actually. In fact, they went out I think it was a Friday morning. They'd just been paid and brought us back a can of beer each. And they sent out for food during the following day and brought us in sandwiches from a Danish shop, presumably. And generally speaking, they came in and looked to see who we were. I said we got visited by quite a lot of the members of this. It was a signal school. But unfortunately, we were stuck up on about the third floor. And although I suggested that we possibly might manage to get out of this place, we hadn't got a map between us. And being on the third floor, it was quite a long drop down, although we did toy with the idea of knotting together the bed gear, but I don't think it would have got us anywhere that way, and my pilot decided that it was a more of a waste of time. And in retrospect, our one best effort probably of escaping was thrown away. But the feeling one gets, or one got when one landed, the nearest thing I can say is that it was rather like missing the last train home at night and having a very long way to go. You wonder what in the world you're going to do when you sort of land down there in some strange place and think, well, my goodness, I've lost the last plane home. How the dickens, where do I go from here? And probably that is rather, I suppose a point of weak character as an officer, probably. One should have been on one's merit, top of one's form at such an opportunity to make the best one could. I don't think we would have got very far, actually, because we had to get across from the island we were in to the next island where Copenhagen is, and then get across the straits there, which were very nearly frozen across. So perhaps we wouldn't have made it, but I suppose as a good officer, one should have made the attempt at the time.
Were you able to speak to those Germans who were holding you captive?
Only insofar that they had a smattering of English. I'm afraid my German was limited to a few words, and that was all. So we were able to communicate in the way one does with foreigners with very little language in common.
Did anything significant pass between you?
Not really, no.
Where did you go after the signal school?
Well, then I think the following morning or 2 days later, we were taken down to the station and we put on train. We went down through Flensburg, down as far as Hamburg, where we had to change a train and were taken from there down to Frankfurt am Main and then to Oberursel, where the Dulag Luft, the interrogation and reception camp for prisoners, was.
Can you tell me what happened at Dulag Luft?
Well, we were immediately stuffed in the cooler, which is the solitary confinement, and all our belongings obviously taken away. We were given nothing to do, obviously, with the idea of breaking our concentration to a certain extent. And then I was interrogated by a very charming German lieutenant who spoke English perfectly, who said he'd been to London University, and brought with him a Red Cross form for completion, which contained all the usual red herrings for which we had been forewarned, such as, first of all, we were given our name and number, and then we were required to give all our vital statistics, all our family history and everything else, what squadron we'd come from and where we were stationed and when we took off, etc. And when I refused to give any information bar name and number, I was informed that, well, it was unfortunate that the Red Cross wouldn't be able to be notified of my presence in Germany, and my relatives would not know that I was a prisoner of war. While that sounded a bit alarming, I was fortunately prepared for that, and I told them that in that case I'm afraid my relatives will have to be unaware of the fact that I was a prisoner. And after a bit of argy-bargy and a few arguments about the Germans and concentration camps and a few other things which rather annoyed the German lieutenant, he left me alone, and that's virtually the last I heard of it.
You were telling the Germans that they were running concentration camps,
yes,
weren't you?
And their treatment of the Jews.
So what was his response to that?
I think as far as I recall, he defended it, of course, in their usual way, and didn't seem very pleased that I should raise the subject. But I felt, as a matter of fact, I think the fact that I went a bit on the offensive was a bit in my favour, insofar that he didn't press any much further the argument of information, of squadron, etc. He assured me, of course, that he knew where I'd come from, and he probably did. But he just wanted to get me to confirm it.
Was there any heat and cold treatment?
No, it was very gentlemanly, I must admit. And except for the fact that I was kept without anything to read, I did ask for something, and he said, oh, later, meaning that when I got out of the main cooler part into the main camp, that all would be well.
Was this the main camp at Dulag Luft?
Dulag Luft, yes. But in actual fact, I never got out. I was taken straight out of the cooler, as a matter of fact, because they had what we call a purge. They were then going to take the existing members of the prisoners in Dulag Luft and reduce the numbers, of course, and send them off to a camp. And the day came before I actually left the cooler, so I didn't go through the main camp and I didn't get any sort of equipment which normally prisoners manage to get there, and went straight off to the first camp at Spangenberg.
Did you see anything of Germany on your travels between camps?
No. The only bit of Germany I saw, of course, was going down